Commonwealth, Harlem Nation, New York, Joan Wine, Senior Assistant Attorney General, the athlete.
If please the court, my name is Charles Hayden, and I represent William Willis, who was the subject of an SVP annual review hearing in the Newport News Circuit Court. In this case, the Attorney General sought to admit a report by Dr. Mary O'Dennis that went into a detailed description of how Mr. Willis showed deception on a polygraph examination test. Mr. Willis's counsel objected properly, and the
counsel, when the objection was made to Dr. Dennis's report, not his testimony, but his report coming in as an exhibit, was there any specific objection made to the polygraph information in the report, or was it something more general than that?
There was an attempt made to tell the go into the details of what it was, but twice the court cut off Mr. Willis's counsel as in specifying precisely the place in the report that was objectionable. In pages 13 to 15, specifically page 14 of the appendix, he's asked, "Do you have an objection to ordering admitting the report of Dr. Dennis, making it part of the record?" "Yes, sir." It has inadmissible material, and he's in the middle of proceeding to describe his cutoff. He says, the court says, Dr. Dennis, he says his report has admissible stuff in it that Mr. Willis's counsel says. The judge again says, "Well, I'm going to defer ruling, I'm going to reserve ruling at this point. I'll make my decision after Dr. Dennis makes his report orally."
What page are you on?
I'm on page 14 and 15. So there, he's initially trying to describe.
It doesn't sound like the trial court's cutting anybody off to me. It sounds like the trial court's just wanting to.
I'm looking specifically at the bottom of page 14. Mr. Root starts to say it still has inadmissible material, and then there's dash dash. The judge cuts him off. He starts at the top of 15 to say his report has inadmissible stuff in it. Certainly, the judge at this point has been put on reasonable notice that there's problems with the report.
It's
the judge
pretty,
has an duty to
hold on. It's a pretty complicated, pretty long report. If I were a trial judge and you just said to me, "Judge Kelsey, there's some inadmissible stuff in there," I would probably have no idea what you're talking about.
And your response would be, "Well, what are you referring to?" But the judge has a strange lack of curiosity about it. He's repeatedly told there's inadmissible stuff. "Well, what are you referring to, Mr. Bruce?" But the judge cuts him off and just says, proceeds to go on. I'm going to let him make his testimony. Then on page 36 of the appendix, he renews his objection. And Mr. Bruce says, "Judge, it contains material. My objection is the same, Judge. There's material information in the report that the doctor knows is inadmissible, that the Commonwealth knows is inadmissible." And then the judge cuts him off at that point and proceeds to go into long colloquy. The judge at page 36 to 37, and then the judge again does not make inquiry as to what is this inadmissible material. But he's been repeatedly told there's inadmissible material, and the judge just doesn't ask and simply cuts him off from even going through his description of what it is that was said. And to make it very explicit what was wrong, on page 65 of the appendix, that's the Dr. Dennis's report, Dr. Dennis writes, "The reports of each question, polygraph question, showed deception. As the results were received, Mr. Willis was given opportunities to explore why the deception was indicated, and he fails this opportunity to explain why these reports." the section was shown. Then on 68, he again says, Mr. Willis underwent a sexual history polygraph examination on April 29, 2013. And he proceeds to quote the questions that were asked, and he says, the report indicates there was evidence of deception to those two questions, questions 44 and 45. In his interview for this report, Mr. Willis said he does not know why he failed those questions. Clearly inadmissible material.
Let me ask you a question. You talked about page 36 when the court is talking about what's going on, and it seems from page 36 that the court clearly understands that there might be hearsay evidence in that report. Don't we rely upon the court to know what's hearsay and what's admissible and not admissible? Aren't we dealing with a harmless error here?
No. The part of the problem is, although, interestingly, the judge starts talking about hearsay, of course, the objection isn't hearsay. It's just flatly inadmissible evidence regarding the results of the polygraph test.
He clearly is on the wavelength of inadmissible evidence.
Right. And so then on page 38, he asks the attorney general at the hearing, he's asking him about the admissibility of these reports, and the attorney general makes the assertion, I've never had an annual review where reports didn't come in. He's saying, regardless of contents of the reports, they come in, was the argument of the attorney general. And the judge says, okay, let's try it. I'll admit it. Note your exception. I think the attorney general was a little surprised with this. Both reports, Judge? Yes, both of the reports, he says. So he's clearly made his ruling where he's never given the defense counsel the chance to go and specify particularly to quote the sections, but he's made known with reasonable certainty there's inadmissible material in this. Now, what was interesting normally you would presume the trial judge has the ability to, with his training and so on, law training, to be able to pull out the inadmissible from the admissible material, but not where he very explicitly states on the record that he's going to admit clearly and consider clearly inadmissible material. On page 24 of the appendix, this is when Dr. Dennis is testifying. It's at this point the attorney general asked, has he taken any polygraph exams yet? Objection. It's inadmissible, Judge. I think that any answer he gives is going to be inadmissible related to a polygraph. Judge says, overrule the objection. Interestingly, the attorney general at the hearing very explicitly asked an improper question, says, now what's the significance of the results of this polygraph examination? And the defense counsel properly objects. Judge, he's asking him directly for the results of the polygraph.
He's not asking whether he was telling the truth or whether he wasn't. Isn't he asking the question, what difference does it make how he answers the polygraph?
The attorney general has just asked very explicitly, what are the results of the polygraph examination? The defense counsel said, Judge, he just asked him directly for the results of the polygraph. Attorney General, I'm asking him how it's relevant to his treatment process.
Mr. Hayden, if you can calm down.
I'm sorry.
Just hold up. Did the expert testify as to the actual results, as opposed to testifying generally about his use of polygraphs and it factors into his opinions?
You know, it was interesting. After the attorney general makes this argument, this explicitly asked for the answer or the results of the polygraph, the judge proceeds to say, overrule the objection, say, I will allow the answer, note your exception. And the defense counsel said, note my strenuous objection, Judge. And he says, so noted, go ahead. And so the judge very explicitly saying, I'm going to consider the results of the polygraph. I want to hear this testimony that the Supreme Court has
Mr. Hayden, I think when you skip the next response by the Commonwealth, you sort of take this out of context. What the Commonwealth next says is, I'm not asking, without telling me the results, I'm asking how is it relevant, the administration of a polygraph, my interpolation there, to his treatment process. And so that's what the judge then says he is going to allow in. I don't think it's correct to read it to say they're allowing the results in.
He says, I'm asking him how it's relevant for to the treatment process. The defense counsel responds, he's asking for an indirect answer to what he can't do directly.
Right.
And it wasn't answered.
The rest of the testimony is all about how that guides
right.
the treatment plan.
Right. And what was interesting was all of the judge has...
Mr. Hayden, isn't your strongest argument not that the testimony went there, but that the court then admitted the report that did have the results in it?
I agree. I do agree with that. The interesting thing was that after the judge explicitly said he was willing to entertain this testimony about how what the results were and how it's relevant to his treatment process, then the witness actually, on his own, refrains from... He draws back and shows discretion and says, well, he starts talking in general terms about how we use a polygraph in treatment. So it's interesting, the actual testimony of Dr. Dennis on the stand wasn't really that bad. It was, but where this colloquy is significant is that it shows that the judge was willing to countenance and consider that testimony. It's reflective of he's considering when he looks at the report too. He's looking at right there at the results and he's considering it. He doesn't see any problem, as evidenced by the court's ruling, very explicit rulings. I can consider the results of the test, and that's and so that's where the significance of this interchange is. As the judge has specifically revealed by his statements, he sees no problems with considering the test results. And even if it's used just to show how it's relevant to his treatment process, this court very clearly said in the Turner case, I cited in the brief, you can't consider it for any reason in a court proceeding. They use it as a treatment basis. Law enforcement can use it out of court. They use it in sex offender treatment. You just can't admit it into court. It can't be discussed. You can't talk about willingness to take the test. You can't talk about the polygraphs at all.
You think Turner goes that far?
I'm sorry?
You think Turner goes that far to say you can't talk about using a polygraph as a tool as long as you don't reveal the results to the court?
I think so. The Turner case states we do not, by this holding, intend to impose any restrictions on the use of polygraph as a tool for law enforcement or in the treatment, therapy, monitoring, or evaluation of offenders.
And that will require, isn't that it, treatment? Evaluation of offenders?
Yeah. They can use it out of court, fine, to their heart's content.
Right.
It's a sex offender treatment. It says that the court goes on in the case, the Turner case, they go on to say, although those making use of such tests should be aware the results will not be admissible in judicial
proceedings. That's not what we said.
Even in the probation hearing.
That is not what we said. I'll read it. Our holding is limited to the exclusion of the opinions of the polygraph operator or others purporting to offer expert opinion interpreting test results. That's what we said.
Your Honor, I was quoting from right at the very bottom of page 744 when the court says, although those making use of such tests should be aware that the results will not be admissible in judicial proceedings.
And that's the answer to your question. The results, the test results, the test is not there, but the results will not be admissible. This gentleman is saying this polygraphic test is an integral part of the substance abuse treatment, and this is the significance of administering the test.
In the report, they describe the test results as showing deception. It was page 65 of Dr. Dennis's report. He says the answers to each question indicated deception. He was given an opportunity to explain why deception was indicated. He wasn't able to do it. And on page 68, the polygraph examination report indicates there was evidence of deception to questions 44 and 45. In his interview, Mr. Willis said he does not know why he failed those questions. They're clearly asking him about How did he do on the polygraph test? He flunked it. He failed the test. They're using the term failed. Showed deception. Clearly inadmissible under all of the long-standing uniform, without exception, it's polygraph results are unreliable. They're not admissible in court proceedings because of, and there's, I'm unable to find a single, went on with many, many, many cases I cited by the Virginia Supreme Court excluding consideration of these tests. Now, if he says something, for example, in the colloquy afterwards, he makes incriminating, that's admissible. There are no problems with bringing that in.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Jill Ryan. I'm here on behalf of the Office of the Attorney General representing the Commonwealth in this matter. This appeal arises out of Mr. Willis's second annual review as a sexually violent predator in his civil commitment. And the Newport News Circuit Court's determination that Willis remains a sexually violent predator in need of secure inpatient treatment. Mr. Willis was initially determined to be a sexually violent predator in 2001. And was entitled to annual review hearings wherein the Commonwealth has the burden to prove he remains a sexually violent predator and that in the consideration of the factors in 37.2-912, there is no lesser restrictive alternative than civil commitment.
Ms. Ryan, you in your brief, I think fairly acknowledge that the results of the polygraph exam cannot come in. The Billups case, which was not a sexually violent predator case, it says that, and it's almost a tautology. You cannot introduce the results. Part of the problem in this case is you have two reports that have the results that were admitted, irrespective of all this discussion about the testimony of the expert. It's harmless error if you have inadmissible evidence and admissible evidence, and the trial court is hearing it, and they can determine which is and which is not. In this case, the trial court said that it was all admissible, and that's the dilemma. It's not a harmless error if, in fact, the trial court rules that it is admissible in the face of many, many lines of cases that say it's not. So it's not a question of whether he separated it out. He declared it was admissible, and as a result, he did rely on it. Now, the appendix in this case doesn't reveal it because it's a photocopy. But the record in this case has the judge's yellow highlighting of all of the results of the polygraph case tests. I don't know whether you consulted the actual record.
I have not, Your Honor.
But this report submitted to the judge is annotated, presumably by the judge. And when it gets to the question of the results of the polygraph, it's very clear that somebody that said that it was admissible was focusing on it. So there's the problem. Focus on that.
Okay. And I had not, just to clarify, consulted the record to see that highlighting myself. I would tell the court, again, the judge is still presumed to be able to separate out the inadmissible from the admissible, but the larger context in terms of the use of the polygraph, I'll allow the Turner case and use it as a treatment tool. I think part of the reason the issue is coming up is because there's a repeated discussion over the years about Mr. Willis's taking accountability for certain offenses. And that's how Dr. Dennis explained it in terms of how the polygraph is used. So the importance of it is not so much, as Dr. Dennis testified, whether he passed or whether he failed, but that larger context and that accountability.
But counsel, you do concede, don't you, that though the statute waives authentication and other best evidence and all the other, you know, trifling evidentiary rules, the report is admissible prima facie. Like a PSR or any other kind of report, it can include information which is inadmissible, right?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Accept that as an assumed widespread consensus view. At any point in this trial court proceeding, was the trial judge told, I object to the polygraph results in the report?
No, Your Honor. The Commonwealth's position is he was never advised of that. It was repeatedly stated as inadmissible material, inadmissible stuff, and I believe it's on page 39.
Well, it was repeatedly stated not that the polygraph is inadmissible stuff. At the time the report came in, it says the report has inadmissible stuff in it. And the judge said, like so many trial judges do, let's just press on and we'll deal with it as it comes up. It never came up.
It did not, Your Honor. And in following up on a question regarding from Mr. Hayden, ultimately the court on appendix page 39 again gave counsel the opportunity to say, I'm going to let you say whatever you want to say on the record about the introduction of these reports. And there was no other objection made.
So the trial judge ever say, I don't want to hear any more from you about your objections. You're shut down. You've made your objection. I've ruled this done.
The Commonwealth's position is the judge did not do that. I understand, as Mr. Hayden pointed out, there are a couple of places where there's dashes and the judge does talk next. But I think it's ultimately cured overall when the judge said, here's your opportunity. You can say whatever you want to say about the admission of these reports other than what you've already said. And counsel remained silent as to that issue.
Let me ask you this. The second opinion from Dr. Nelson, certainly pursuant to statute, is sent to the court. Is it your position that it's automatically admitted into evidence?
That is our position, Your Honor. And in relying on that, I'm relying on the language in 372-910, subsection D, where it directs that the court's findings, and those findings being either the respondent remains a sexually violent predator or not, is to be based on the report and any other evidence admitted.
But when it says the report, it's not talking about the secondary report. It's talking about the primary report, isn't it?
Well, it is in the
same. It doesn't say reports. It's not plural.
That's
it's singular.
That's correct. I could see it is singular. But I would tell the court that not in every instance do we have more than one report. We always have a first report on behalf of the
community. Exactly, and that's what the statute concerns. So I'm asking you, why do you think it includes the second report?
Because of the fact that this proceeding, the annual review proceeding, is different than the trial, as we pointed out. There's a different modality of getting the expert reports. The expert reports are automatically, the opinions are made known to the court. They're for the benefit of the court.
Well, they're sent to the court. Honestly, I mean, it says they are to be sent to the court.
Yes, it does. I mean,
you could say the same thing about fingerprint evidence or gun analysis. They send a copy to the court. The clerk puts it in the file. But that doesn't make it automatically in evidence, does it?
And again, we are relying on 372-910-D, and I understand it's singular, but there's no, from the Commonwealth's perspective, I don't know how else to read 372-910-D to consider only one report, but not another one that is statutorily mandated to, in certain circumstances, to be provided.
Well, couldn't it mean that the report's not automatically to be considered by the court, but it can be offered? It certainly could be offered. It could be put into evidence, and the courts can consider whatever evidence is in front of it. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's not saying it can't consider it. It just means that it's not automatically a part of the evidence to be considered.
That's one interpretation, but the Commonwealth's interpretation is reading that section in light of the fact that it's even required to be submitted in the first phase. When you consider that against the initial trial phase, where the defense can get an expert, sort of the traditional consulting expert, and not have that report automatically admitted, which at one point in time the trial section in the SVP Act did require an automatic submission of that defense report, and the General Assembly changed that, but left 372-910 unaltered.
And right, which might mean because it didn't think those were included in that in the first place. I mean, it kind of explains why they would not have changed that like they changed the other statute.
The statute also talks about who does the report. Shall be a licensed psychiatrist or licensed clinical psychologist who is skilled in the diagnosis and risk assessment of sex offenders and knowledgeable about the treatment, etc., etc. Surely, it's not admissible per se against the objections that the person who actually authored the report is not qualified to do it.
That would be correct, Your Honor, but we have, in this case, there was no objection to.
Well, that's true in this case. What I'm saying is that if those qualifications or conditions are a part of the statute, then it can't be per se admissible.
That would be a well-founded objection that the person, of course, was not qualified under the statute to provide that report. I would agree with that.
What about the fact that the witness isn't there to be cross-examined? I mean, the statute clearly gives the defendant the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses.
And similar to other statutes, both in the criminal and the civil realm, it's our position that, again, that report not only had to be submitted to the court, to the commissioner, to all counsel, so those opinions are well known, and again, for the benefit of the court, not your traditional defense expert kind of report. It's similar to 19.2-182.5, the NGRI acquittee reports has almost the identical language. And the other examples we cited, they're before the court, and the respondent would have the opportunity to exercise his right to cross-examine the witness.
Did Mr. Willis's trial court counsel ask to subpoena the witness or request the opportunity to cross-examine? Did he even want him there?
He did not, Your Honor. And he actually stated on the record, I'm sorry, I don't have the page in front of me, but right at the beginning when Assistant Attorney General Friedman asked for both reports to be submitted and Mr. Roots objected, the court asked, well, and Mr. Roots said, and Dr. Nelson's not here, he was asked, well, didn't he do a second opinion? Yes. Did he do that at the request of the respondent? Yes. Did you subpoena him? He said, no, obviously I didn't want his opinion in judge. And I'm paraphrasing, I don't have exactly.
And this is not a Crawford case, a confrontation clause case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it could have been. I mean, they didn't raise the point.
Actually, Your Honor, I would say it's not, because although it's an unpublished case, this court ruled in Graves versus Commonwealth, which is a sexually violent predator case, that the Sixth Amendment confrontation clause does not apply in SVP proceedings. So again, it was unpublished, but this court has already made that ruling, so it's not a confrontation clause case a la Crawford.
Mr. Willis was the one who actually called for the second report in this instance, was he not?
Yes.
And so why couldn't he then exercise, having called for it, why couldn't he exercise the right to say, I don't want it in evidence. I'm not going to call the witness. I don't want you to consider this report. Obviously, it's not favorable to me.
I didn't subpoena him because I didn't want it in evidence.
That's what he said. And this is where there's a difference, I believe, between the annual review statute and the trial statute, because the SVP Act obviously is a wholly statutory proceeding, and the annual review itself and these reports are for the benefit of the court. There has to be a report from the commissioner. But then it says if the commissioner's report recommends discharge of the respondent, or if the respondent himself is requesting discharge, then there shall be a second opinion. It's that safeguard opinion on behalf of public safety to show the court. In this case, Mr. Willis was requesting discharge. In closing argument, he asked either first to be found no longer to be a sexually violent predator, or secondarily to be conditionally released. So at his request, there shall be a second opinion. So if he exercises or is able to exercise a right to then withdraw that opinion and not have that opinion into evidence, then how does the court make its decision?
It doesn't make any sense, counsel, because it seems like whichever side wanted the opinion could bring it in easily.
I'm sorry?
Whichever side thought the opinion was helpful could bring it in themselves, right?
Exactly.
That's true, yes.
And that wouldn't prevent the Commonwealth from bringing it in. They just got to have the witness there to get it in.
Once again,
if the Commonwealth wanted in, they could subpoena the witness and say, did you do the report, hand it to him, he looks at it, and the defendant would have the opportunity to cross-examine him, and it is what it is.
Yes, we could have subpoenaed the witness, but again, relying on the fact that Dr. Nelson's report was largely corroborative of Dr. Dennis's report and opinion, and relying on the plain language of the statute, that it would be admissible is why we didn't in this case.
Well, if that's an error, is that the end of the story? If it was error to introduce that?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because we believe it's harmless error, ultimately. If we took out Dr. Nelson's report altogether, and quite frankly, if we took out Dr. Dennis's report altogether, what the trial court is left with is Dr. Dennis's testimony at trial uncorroborated that Mr. Willis remained a sexually violent predator and that he remained in the
uncorroborated or uncontested?
I'm sorry?
Uncontested, you mean?
Yes.
I think you said uncorroborated.
I'm sorry, yes. Uncontested. Thank you for the correction.
Ms. Ryan, I note the date of this hearing, and I note today's date.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you know where I'm going.
I believe I do. I would not presume.
That was very good. You, you shouldn't assume that you know where I'm going, but I think you are correct. When is his next review?
His next annual review, it's either April 24th or 25th, I apologize. But I will tell the court that actually there has been an agreed order entered between Mr. Willis and the Commonwealth on a stipulation that he remains a sexually violent predator at this point, but ordering the preparation of a conditional release plan. Not saying Mr. Willis will or will not be conditionally released, but it's in between that phase now. He has been, again, found to remain a sexually violent predator. We're getting a conditional release plan, and we'll be going to court.
Well, now, let's explore that for just a second. This is an agreement between Mr. Willis and the Commonwealth. Presumably with the benefit of counsel.
Yes.
It's an agreement that the Commonwealth has entered into with him that establishes now that he's a sexually violent predator and only has the issue of a conditional release.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, what does that do to all these questions that we're arguing about today?
I would say at least as with respect to Mr. Willis's request that this be remanded for a hearing without these alleged errors or alleged erroneous evidence would make it moot. Because, again, we are a year later. He's once again been established to remain a sexually violent predator.
And he agrees.
And he agrees.
So why are we going forward with this appeal?
She's the appellee.
But in all candor, wouldn't it have been helpful to have alerted us to that fact?
Yes, Your Honor. When I looked at sort of the standards regarding mootness, to be honest, on the one hand, like I said, it seems moot regarding these issues with Mr. Willis, but I could understand
the court's... If we made an evidentiary call and sent it back to the trial court, the first thing the trial court would say is, I'm not having a hearing. Y'all have already agreed to this.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It may not be moot, but for the agreement. I mean, the capable of repetition and evading review standard would probably trump a bare mootness question. But this isn't a bare mootness question. You have agreement between the parties that he continues to be a sexually violent predator. That's different.
And in looking at that, whether that's a moot or whether the larger issue, particularly regarding the second opinion report, whether that the court would find that moot or, again, capable, you know, of repetition. So,
I suspect that I would like to hear from counsel to Mr. Willis on this only on the issues of mootness, and it may very well. I don't speak for the whole court, but it may very well result in a request to have both sides address that in writing before we decide this case. But, Mr. Hayden, would you like the opportunity to answer that question?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Ms. Ryan.
Your Honor, the reason I don't think it's moot is although there's an agreement that was entered that it constitutes a sexually violent predator, there is a recommendation that's been made that he should be conditionally released. It hasn't been approved by the court yet. We haven't had a hearing yet. We don't know whether the judge is going to say, well, we're going to go ahead and do and proceed to conditionally release him.
The first part is what I'm concerned about.
Well, the ruling on the polygraph stuff may have affected the judge's determination in the original, this proceeding before this court, the polygraph test results we can't say that it didn't influence his results, his decision that, well, I can't conditionally release him. Test results show he's still showing deception, and we've got problems with it.
But that's what you're going to be before the court for in after the agreement that he is a sexually violent predator. However, he can be conditionally released. You've got apparently an agreement and an opportunity to address that question separately, apparently pretty soon.
There's the annual review, and it takes a while to get this appeal heard. That's certainly true.
But why didn't the agreement say, look, if I lose this appeal, let's agree on where we're going to go from here. But if I win the appeal, I don't want to make any concession or have a contract that absolutely designates him by agreement of parties as a sexually violent offender.
Yeah, my understanding is that Dr. Dennis this year came back with a report recommending him for conditional release. We've had to get a second report. We haven't gotten it yet. We don't even know that the second report's going to come back and recommend conditional release. So we don't know for a fact what's going to happen. It's not a foregone conclusion that he will be conditionally released.
True, but we know the answer to the first question because he's agreed to it. I mean, we're having all of this discussion about errors in the case below, most of which are procedural and preservation questions, and we have some very fascinating questions about what the statutes mean and whether a report is self-authenticating, et cetera, in a case where that issue is probably moot. The second issue is not, and that's the conditional release. Well, the court will take up the matter, and we may very well request you to respond in writing. But at this point, the court is adjourned.
All rise.